Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The defendant is on trial not for being a police officer. It's not the state versus the police. He's not on trial for who he was. He's on trial for what he did.
Closing arguments in the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. We ask the former Minneapolis police chief, Janae Harto, will there ever be real reform? Then, how modern masculinity is driving men to take their own lives. I speak to a father who lost his son to suicide and to expert Andrew Reiner. Also on the program.
What she taught me was to feel that you're part of this place, not a visitor.
Hari Srinivasan talks to the director and the star of the cult hit, Oscar-nominated documentary, My Octopus Teacher. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. It is now up to the jury as the prosecution and the defense laid out their closing arguments in the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd.
This wasn't policing. This was murder. The defendant is guilty of all three counts. All of them. And there's no excuse.
Start from the point of the presumption of innocence and see how far the state can get. I submit to you that the state has failed to meet its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
And the city of Minneapolis is on edge as it awaits a verdict. The National Guard has been deployed to parts of the city and public schools are moving to distance learning from Wednesday. Though this case may be coming to a close, the U.S. policing system is still on trial on the streets and in the court of public opinion. Recently, the police shooting of 13-year-old Adam Toledo sparked more protest as people show they are sick and tired of a justice system that they believe is rigged against black and brown people. Listen to this shocking statistic. The New York Times reports that since the first day of this trial, there have been more than three police killings per day. Joining me now is Janae Harto, the former police chief of Minneapolis. Harto is currently president and CEO of Vitals Aware Services. It's an app that helps first responders deal with vulnerable individuals. She's joining me from Sarasota, Florida. Chief Harto, welcome to the program. I just want to, you know, get your take. You've heard the, you know, important bits of the trial. You've heard bits of the closing arguments. Essentially, the state saying that, you know, this is not against the police. It's not the state against the police. It's against a person who did not use duty of care and who, you know, fulfills the charges we laid. The defense saying, you know, presume innocence and that there is reasonable doubt. What do you feel right now as it goes to the jury?
I feel pretty confident that the prosecution has done an outstanding job. I am incredibly proud of the men and women leadership, certainly in the Minneapolis Police Department, that have testified. I am not surprised at all that they stood up and said this was wrong and denounced the actions of Derek Chauvin. He's clearly the exception and not the rule, and he tarnished his badge and everything it stands for.
In a sense, that, of course, is what Chief Arredondo said. And the prosecutor, in his closing arguments, he quoted the current chief, and this is what he said.
Remember during opening statement, counsel said that the defendant followed the rules and followed his training? Did you hear evidence of that? Did you hear evidence of that from the stand? Or did you hear something quite different? The chief of police testified He violated their use of force policy. He violated their de-escalation policy. He violated the duty to render emergency aid. No. You heard the trainer, Lieutenant Mercil. We don't train this. This is not who we are. No. That representation was simply wrong. That's just a story. What the defendant did was not policing. What the defendant did was an assault.
Chief Hartow, I mean, first off, would you have taken the stand and testified against one of your officers?
Absolutely. This was shock the conscience. It went against everything we do on a daily basis. Sanctity of life and procedural justice were the tenets, frankly, of my tenure and the way that we operate on a daily basis. Obviously, there are times where there's that exception, but that's who the Minneapolis Police Department is.
And do you think, I mean, you know, look, the statistics show, the facts show, the cases show that generally police do not get held accountable. And if they are, they do not get convicted. But we have seen an extraordinary crack, as people have been saying, in that blue line, with not only the chief, as we saw, testify for the prosecution, but also Chauvin's superior. Other members of the Minneapolis Police Department signed a letter. In other words, lots of them testified against him. Is this, do you think there is a permanent crack in police standing up for those who they know are bad apples?
I do. As we hire a better quality of officer, as we look to the entire system, the criminal justice system, when I was still the police chief, the prosecuting attorney moved away from the grand jury process and took on the case of the officer-involved incident himself. And so we're having more and more people come together, and it benefits the honorable men and women that serve our country in policing every day and the communities they serve to be able to have police legitimacy and that process. Bad cops can't get away with that. Cops who are using excessive force and deadly force and, frankly, murdering an individual like the case with Derek Chauvin, murdering George Floyd, this cannot happen.
Well, you know, you're obviously, we clearly know where you stand, given what you've just said. And I want to ask you, because you were the first female chief of police in Minneapolis, but you also had to resign in 2017. There was a police shooting under your watch. It was a black officer and it was a white woman, I think a tourist from Australia. What happened and what does it feel like to be chief when these terrible things happen?
It's really hard to explain the enormous sense of responsibility you feel for the actions of one of your officers. They're my family member, and no one can believe that their family member could act so egregiously. This was an incident in which the officers responded to a 911 call, and this female was actually the 911 caller. And so apparently the officer believed she was a threat. He was startled, and he shot one shot through the window. From inside a squad car. Inappropriate, another case of this was not an appropriate tactic. This is not how we teach people. The community was, of course, upset. And I do feel like all of leadership and the officers involved should be accountable. But there are challenges when we're simply removing people and we're not fixing some of the systemic issues we've had in policing.
Well, Chief, you know, that brings me straight to the case of Derek Chauvin. And I don't believe this was brought in the courtroom during the trial. But everybody knows that he was moved around because he did have, I think, more than, you know, 20 complaints about him in his various previous locations before he ended up in Minneapolis in the police department. You know, do you think now police unions who very much protect their own and the general, you know, structure around policing will stop that? I mean, we've seen how it happened in the Catholic Church with the priests who abused kids. Instead of dealing with the situation, they were moved around from church to church to keep, you know, this predatory behavior and this abusive behavior up. Will this change, do you think, in Minneapolis, in the United States?
I think it will. For years, I have discussed the challenges of not just having the responsibility of disciplining officers as the police chief, but I didn't have the full authority. We have an arbitration process that allows a termination case to go before an arbitrator who in 50 to 60% of all cases in the state of Minnesota, since over half, would side with the employee, and instead of a termination, instead of upholding that, would give them time off without pay and maybe some remedial training. We also need to address the mental health issues that we have with our own officers. The things that they see and go through on a daily basis are not addressed properly. And I think if you look at who are involved in these cases, you will find that common denominator. That in no way is an excuse for their actions, but I do think we need to address what policing does to an individual.
I mean, again, in Chauvin's case, we understand that he was a field training officer helping to train and evaluate officers coming out of the academy. This is a guy who had been moved from a series of complaints to finally ending up in your police department where he was a field training officer. And you yourself had reforms. You called it Minneapolis Police Department 2.0. Why aren't the reforms working? Because we hear so much about how reforms are constantly being put in, but they don't seem to be working.
Well, I guess I would challenge the idea that they're not working. It takes time. The Minneapolis Police Department is 153 years old. So those policing and the culture and how people operate have been, created over those century and decades. And so it takes time. So I became chief in 2012. We began many progressive initiatives, implicit bias training, procedural justice, not just in training, but thread throughout everything that we do. I put in the sanctity of life, the duty to intervene, all the community programs we had. Two things happen. One, budgets get cut and you no longer can do the things that connect you with the community and make you in a position to where you can create relationships and build trust. Trust and relationships aren't built in a crisis. It has to be done before. So if officers only have time to handle 911 calls and they don't have any opportunities to do those things in the community, that impacts trust. So I think we need to allow it time to work. And so it's not as simple as it's not working. We don't know how things could be. And it's like the crime that didn't occur. We can only track the crimes that occur. We can't track the ones that didn't.
Except that there are some really shocking statistics. Even in Minneapolis, barely 10 miles from where the trial is being held, we had the killing of Dante Wright. We've got all these dreadful statistics. Since the Chauvin case began, which was March 29th, at least 69 people were killed by law enforcement around the United States. Since 2014, about 3 people are killed by police each day, and most of these men are Black or Latino. Black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. Again, there's a major problem. I mean, racism is obviously, the basis of the problem. Do you agree with that? Let me just ask you, do you agree that's the basis of the problem?
I do think as a country, we have a problem with racism. It's a societal issue. We hire from society. So it isn't shocking to me to see that you have that within an organization. What we need to do is reinvent what we as a society agree to what 21st century policing should look like, how we want officers to do it. And we need to diversify our organizations. And we can't do that as long as this perception is all about law and order and how we operate. And we need people of color and women to feel comfortable to be a part of our organizations. So then again, these are systemic inequalities that have been created over countless decades as well. And that's going to take time to change. But I think that this highlights that we need to change. And we're starting to come together to have the conversation about where to begin.
So you've heard the chant, obviously, which I don't think it started, but it got louder after George Floyd was killed. Defund the police. It wasn't get rid of the police entirely. It was stop pouring money into police departments and into, the infrastructure for issues that are not being dealt with because you're just pouring more money into it. And it's kind of separate certain police actions from what should be community service actions and calls, like mental health calls and domestic violence and stuff like that. Where do you stand on that?
I believe we need both entities to be properly funded. So one, we look at what we want police departments to do, how much we want them to engage with the community, our police activities leagues, all of our community programs need to be appropriately funded. And we still need to manage crime, so we need enough police officers and resources to be able to manage all of those things. The flip side is we can't expect police officers to handle every societal failures. And when people have mental health issues that need to be addressed, they have long-term problems, they're living in generational poverty, these are things that police can't address, and we need resources for people in those. And they need to be properly funded as well. So I think we have to have both. We can't simply defund the police without a plan in place of who's going to address the issues now that you can no longer just call the police with whatever it is that you need to have fixed. Mm-hmm.
And what about, again, we have seen concurrently with this trial, we've seen more mass shootings. We've seen, you know, we just keep seeing these shootings, and we know that guns are liberally available in the United States. The statistics, again, are really shocking, and we can see how many innocents are harmed, are killed because of this. You know, the NRA and the gun rights people say, I think they say it's not guns, it's people who kill, or that more guns make it a safer place, more guns in the hands of the good guys. Where do you stand after all these mass shootings that just become part of the background noise now?
Well, this has been a concern of mine and work that I've done for many, many years when President Obama was in office and along with Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. We have too much access to guns. That's the challenge. Anytime you want to talk about any measures to prevent that access, it's about control. And people, if you look at the stories that you see, there are more stories in which people are killed by someone with a gun, not somebody who's protecting themselves, but somebody who is out to do harm. It's a very complex scenario, but the reality of there's too much access, and we need to be looking at universal background checks, a lot of the loopholes that allow people to get guns that shouldn't have guns. You know, other countries do not have that type of access to guns like the United States does.
Yeah, and I'm sitting in one of those countries that doesn't have that kind of access and that does have laws precisely because of a mass shooting that they then decided, you know, the laws needed to be changed and sensible reforms put in, sensible gun control. I was really stunned to read that, you know, guns account for more suicides in the United States than they do in than homicides. Did you come across that when you were chief?
We had more street violence than we did, but we did see the increase in suicides, of course, by gun. It's simple, it's quick. And then there again, it's about access. So if my dad has guns in the home and I'm having challenges and I want to take my life, there's that potential there. And if the gun's not there, the potential's not there.
And I just want to end by just bringing it back to the trial. What if Derek Chauvin is acquitted? We already see Minneapolis, the state, putting in National Guard, putting some schools back to online from home, distance learning, starting on Wednesday. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think people are going to be very vocal, and I think things are going to be, frankly, dangerous for many people if the result isn't what they want. I think we're going to see a lot of uptick in 911 calls and activity, regardless of what it turns out to be. The challenge for all of us moving forward is this is then about the criminal justice system, and we have to ask if it works and what we need to change with the criminal justice system. This isn't simply just a police issue. But unfortunately, I think it's going to be looked upon as police are able to get away with things. And I think that's detrimental.
On that note, Chief Janae Harto, thank you so much indeed for joining us today. And now we continue that conversation on the rising suicide crisis. According to the CDC, suicide rates have surged by 33% between 1999 and 2019. And most of these people are men who are suffering in silence. It is a global problem. Here in the UK, suicide is the number one killer of men under 45. Joining me now on this is British journalist Michael McCarthy. His son, Ross, took his own life in February as he battled with depression in the midst of pandemic lockdowns. Also with us is writer Andrew Reiner. His book, Better Boys, Better Men, examines how modern masculinity is hurting men. So, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Mike McCarthy, if I could just start by asking you, I know it's painful. How are you dealing? How is your family coping with what happened to your son, just in February?
We're all devastated. There's a massive void in our lives. Ross was only 31. He was a warm-hearted, loving, funny man who was devoted to his family. And what we're finding now is that, I guess, we're moving at a different pace, each member of his family. Some days are better than others, but in general, his mum, myself, his brother Tom and sister Laura are feeling desolate. We're lost, and we are slowly coming to realise that our lives will never be the same again.
What were some of the issues that he was dealing with and that he felt he couldn't get help for?
Ross had fought for a very long time with severe depression, more than 10 years, and he tried pretty much everything. Some things seemed to work better than others. In the end, he had to pay for and find his own counsellor because the counsellor that was provided didn't seem to work for him. At Christmas, when we were allowed to meet as a family, when the COVID restrictions were lifted temporarily, we celebrated the fact that Ross had seemed to have made excellent progress. He seemed, in his words, to finally have cracked it. The counsellor that he found, he particularly related to. And as we as a family discussed the high points of 2020, we all agreed that Ross's progress in his mental health was the best thing that could have happened to us as a family. But it came back, and I think we'll never know for sure, but I think that that was the final straw as far as Ross was concerned. We know how hard he tried. We know how much we talked to him. We know how much we'd listened to him. And we are so devastated by the fact that he was due to get married and couldn't because of COVID. And he had a little son, Charlie, who's just 3 years old. And Ross wrote quite a long farewell letter in which he addressed each member of the family. And in that letter, he spoke to Charlie directly and said, "I tried my kid with everything I have. I just didn't have enough. I love you so much, little Charlie." And we've discussed this, and we know that, you know, if Charlie couldn't hold him back, then none of us could. But he also asked in that letter that we fight for better mental health provision here in the UK. Again, in Ross's words to his brother Tom and sister Laura, "Please fight for mental health. The support is just not there." And the thing that frustrated and confused and angered Ross more than anything else was that he was waiting for therapy and was put on a waiting list for 6 months. We have no anger in our hearts. We have no blame. But we'd like to know why someone who was effectively terminally ill, just in the same way that he might have had terminal cancer, was put on a waiting list for 6 months.
It is so tragic, and I can obviously hear your pain, and I really appreciate you telling the story because it's so important, and there's so many men out there who are in this terrible situation for one reason or another. And I want to ask Andrew Reiner, who's written this book. I mean, you've heard, you know, you can hear Mike's story, you can hear what happened to Ross, but the statistics that you know, you quote, or that are quoted in the book, in the United States, suicide is a statistically far higher killer of men than women in every age group. That's according to the CDC. Globally, suicide rates in men are just over twice as high as for women, according to Our World in Data. You've been studying these issues. What sparked your interest, and how do you explain these huge spikes when it comes to men and suicide now, today?
Well, I just want to say, first of all, that I'm so very, very sorry, you know, for your loss. As the father of a son, the pain must be it's unimaginable. I can't even fathom it. And thank you for sharing your story today for all of us, because this is such an important topic for so many of us who work with boys and young men and who have children. The spike is, you know, what's happening right now with the pandemic is that the pandemic is really it's pulling back the curtain on a massive problem that's already there. A lot of times when it comes to boys and men with depression especially, and to some extent anxiety, but more so depression, we tend to downplay it. And this is true, you know, it's true in the States, it's true in the UK. A lot of the research that I speak about in my book speaks to Australia, because they are also leading the way with a lot of research in this, as well as the UK. But what often happens is that we tend to think that, you know, the rates of depression historically, if you could easily go on and Google depression in men and women, and much of the information you'll find will say that women experience it at a rate of 2 to 1. There's more research coming out, a small but growing body of research, which shows that in fact, when you use a different metric for gauging depression in men, because it not always, but often looks different in boys and men than it does in girls and women. When you use that metric and you combine it with the more traditional ones that really gauge depression in women, you see that gap closing dramatically. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is that, of course, we know that, you know, there's been a lot written about how we know that young men and men often, you know, are reluctant to seek help. And that's very true. But in addition to that, a big part of the problem also is the ways that we are really speaking to boys, and that we're not speaking to boys and to young men. The depression is very real. And to be honest with you, during the course of my research, even though I know that girls and women experience anxiety at higher rates, I think that boys and young men are really going to start to close the gap on anxiety as well.
Andrew, you also wrote about, and I found fascinating, that, you know, in your study, you can see that men, boys, don't have the same friendship group that they can reach out to. They're stoic. They don't talk about it. They don't want to, you know, to tell other people about it. Somewhat different, I think it's been discovered, than what girls do. Maybe they reach out more. Women maybe reach out more and have friends, groups or family that they can talk to more. Tell me about that for boys, and what needs to, you know, what kind of awareness raising needs to happen there.
Sure. So one of the things, there was this common thread that I found that really surprised me when I did the research for my book. So often I'd be going into classrooms and talking to boys, you know, in high school. I would talk to young men in college. I would talk to men in their 20s and 30s and 40s. And I often would say the same thing. I'd say, who do you go to for emotional support? And they always reflexively said, I've got one or two close guy friends. And I'd say, okay, so what does that look like? And they always would say that the things that they were sharing with their close male friends, and it wasn't with a lot of male friends, it was only with one or two, was that it was what I call targeted transparency.
Can I just turn to you, Michael, and ask you, because in the farewell letter that Ross left, he also talked about the pandemic and the lockdown. He said, I guess this is what happens when you lock someone up for long enough. I mean, clearly it had begun to get him down. And we know, and Andrew was referring to it a little bit, how the pandemic has exacerbated mental health at the same time as not, you know, as people not having such access to mental health precisely because of the pandemic. How do you think the lockdown affected your son?
COVID didn't kill my son, but I think that the restrictions added to the weight of the burden that he was already carrying. He was due to marry his fiancée Charlotte last year, and that couldn't go ahead because of the restrictions.
They tried to rearrange it for this month, and then there was uncertainty at the last minute as to whether that could go ahead or not. Ross was a very sporting character. He liked tennis and football. He was a member of the local gym. The gym had closed. He loved nothing better than to take Charlie swimming to swimming classes, and they were closed. As a family, we met at Christmas face to face for the last time with Ross. And we spoke to him every day on FaceTime, but it wasn't the same. Ross was very much devoted to his family, and we couldn't see him face to face, and that was important to Ross. We did discuss the problems that he had, but one thing that I'd like to say, if I may, is that there is nothing wrong with vulnerability in men. Vulnerability is not a weakness. We should speak openly about suicide. We should say the word. It's no worse than cancer. We're still using the language of the Dark Ages. In the United Kingdom, we still refer to committing suicide. And that language goes back to a time when it was illegal. That illegal status was lifted in 1961. But we're still using the same language as though it's the same as committing murder or committing rape. If my son did anything in this world, he did not commit a crime. We have to be open about it. We have to talk about it. I want political leaders to engage with it. Where is the political discourse? Where is the public discussion? Suicide, although great advances have been made in opening up and talking about mental health, there isn't really anywhere near as much discussion, public discussion, about severe depression, anxiety, particularly among young men. As you said, you know, when you consider that the biggest threat to a man in the UK under the age of 45 isn't cancer, it's not road accidents, it's himself. That I have always found a shocking statistic, not just since Ross died. I've always found that shocking. And I don't know why society isn't shocked enough to want to make radical changes in the way that we deal with mental health in this country and around the globe.
It is a shocking statistic. And even when I asked the former chief of police in Minneapolis, you know, I couldn't believe it that, you know, suicides are more prevalent than homicides when it comes to gun violence, for instance. And just before I go back to Andrew, you know, Mike, you've been a broadcaster, you've been a journalist, you know what it's like dealing with the politics and government. What would you say if you could talk to the Prime Minister or whoever is the relevant, you know, minister to deal with something like this? What is the key thing you think is 100% necessary? Because, you know, we're hearing it on college campuses and in many, many parts of this country and, of course, the United States and elsewhere.
There is a crisis across the globe. 800,000 people every year take their own lives. Imagine that over a span of 10 years. Imagine the pain that they leave behind. Imagine the ripple effect. Imagine all those people who feel so helpless that they try to take their own lives but are caught in time. Just think of those numbers for a second. I don't believe, because I'm an optimist, I don't believe that politicians think that there are no votes in this. I'm sure that they would like to do something. I'm sure that they would like to change the debate and make real improvements for the future, because we can't go on like this. We don't hear of the suicide pandemic because we aren't talking about it enough, but it's there.
Andrew Reiner, thank you so much. And Michael McCarthy, thank you for talking to us. And you have really our deepest condolences. And if you know someone in need of help, there are resources available to you. Reach out to the International Association for Suicide Prevention or Befrienders Worldwide. If you're in the United States, reach out to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And now we're going to take a dive into freezing waters with a man who overcame his own mental health struggles through the healing power of the ocean. Natural history filmmaker Craig Foster was burnt out and depressed when he decided to put his career on hold. He took up daily diving at home in Cape Town, South Africa, and he struck up an unusual friendship with a wild octopus. The film was shot over 8 years. It's called My Octopus Teacher, and it documents how this unique bond taught him valuable lessons about balance and connection to the natural world.
I had to have a radical change in my life. And the only way I knew to do it was to be in this ocean with her. And then I had this crazy idea. What happens if I just went every day? But you realize that there's a line that can't be crossed.
The film won a Best Documentary BAFTA, and it is nominated for an Oscar. And here's our Hari Srinivasan talking to diver and producer Craig Foster and the director, Pippa Ehrlich.
Christiane, thanks. Craig Foster, Pippa Ehrlich, thanks for joining us. Craig, take us back to that first day when you, well, met this octopus.
Yeah, it's quite a long time ago now. So she was in a very strange position. She is holding all these shells and stones over her, protecting her. And I, at that time, didn't know what was going on. I didn't even know, was this some strange sort of octopus? And then suddenly she just let them go, and it was this magical moment. And then I followed her to her den and eventually, you know, got to know her so well. But just a really unusual individual.
So, Pippa, how do you get involved in this? You're swimming along with Craig, and he starts telling you this tale that he's been shooting an octopus for days and days and days?
He kind of mentioned vague things to me about this octopus. He never sat me down and told me the whole story, and then one day he did. And he kind of had said, look, I know I said I was never going to make another film, but I think we've got a story here. And, you know, it had been such a transformational experience for him that it was something that he really wanted to share. So, yeah, I was sitting at my desk at work one day, and he sent through the treatment, and I just started crying because something in that story just resonated with me on a very big level. And I think it's because there are so many films and newspaper articles and all sorts of things out at the moment about the like destructive impact of human beings on nature. And this was a really hopeful and inspiring film about the impact of nature on the human being. And that's why I fell in love with it.
Craig, so tell me a little bit about that. I mean, the title says teacher. What was this process like? What was this octopus teaching you?
Well, you can imagine, Hari, if you need to learn about an animal's behavior, where's the best place you could possibly go on this planet to learn? It's not at a university or school or anywhere. It's actually directly from that animal. And if you have the privilege of visiting an animal like that every day for months on end, it's a masterclass every day. And then when that animal, you know, eventually trusts one, you get let into the inner world, the secret world of the octopus. And she let me into her world and showed me behaviors that have not been seen before. So she wasn't, you know, I didn't see her as a pet, anything like that. She's literally wild, wild kin. She taught me at a very, very deep level, a very, very deep level about behavior and about her life.
Pippa, you know, we've lived through an inconvenient truth, which is essentially a giant PowerPoint deck, right, with facts and figures. But this is a different kind of conservation or environmental film in the sense that you're not hitting us over the head with it. It's just sort of a very personal, simple story.
It is. And this was the biggest debate we had during the filmmaking process. It was long conversations deep into the night between Craig and I and my co-director James and I and our EP Ellen Windermuth and Craig's wife Swati. Everybody had a different perspective on how we should do this. But in the end, I felt like the story that we had was so inspiring and so hopeful. And it really, rather than being a portrait of everything that we're doing wrong in the world. And all of the kind of, as I said earlier, the distraction that we are wreaking on the natural world. Craig's relationship to nature provides a different vision for what it means to be a human being, you know, sharing this planet with millions and millions of other species. There was something respectful and awe-inspiring about it. And that's really what I wanted the main message to be. Why would we want the main message to be?
Craig, by the time we get to this point in the film, which the scene that I would call basically first contact, it's almost like this, you know, you've described octopus as an alien earlier on, but there's this moment where you put your finger out and she just reaches one of her tentacles out and touches you.
And then it just happens. I'd put my hand out a tiny bit.
It's something visceral that happens to the audience that's watching. We kind of, by that time, we kind of feel like there's something special going on. What was, do you remember what that moment was like?
Yeah, it's hard to forget that, even that's a time back. So that first moment of contact is obviously very, very powerful. But Hari, she's still not fully trusting. She's testing. She's reaching out and testing. Is this thing safe, as I think it might be? But I'm still, you know, I'm very curious, but I'm very fearful. But it's that moment when she actually comes out the den and becomes totally vulnerable and starts moving around with me and allows her to go, me to go on hunts with her. That's the real power. But you can't necessarily see that as much in the film. But that, for me, was the most moving thing, to have a cephalopod, an animal, you know, it's the most intelligent invertebrate on the planet, trusting a human like this and allowing me into that secret world and showing me these incredible behaviors and her strategy, her sophistication, her tremendous cleverness. That was deeply moving. And that's what really, you know, moved me to my absolute core.
So Pippa, you're probably one of the first people to have seen the footage that he had shot. And, you know, from an outsider's perspective, when you saw some of these scenes, did you think that there was cognition, emotion, things that maybe humans, we want to project onto the octopus, but as Craig is having this relationship with this octopus, because he's getting to know it so well, you're watching the sort of film, what are you thinking?
I mean, my mind is being blown. You know, there were there were things, and I think if I want to think about the emotional world of an octopus, there's a scene where she's learning to hunt the lobsters. And there was something about that because, you know, there's a lot of footage of this. You know, we've picked the best bits and we've told the story as well as we can. But watching those rushes, I could actually see this animal becoming frustrated. And for me, like, that is such a relatable feeling to see in an animal. And of course you can see the connection between her and Craig and how clever she is. But something about that frustration felt very, very real to me.
Craig, it's interesting that you didn't give this octopus a name, didn't treat it as a pet. You even maintained a certain distance through some traumatic experiences in its life when a shark takes an arm away. What was it like in your head to process keeping that certain distance of something that you were essentially growing closer to?
It is very difficult, Hari, but you know, as I said, when you get to know this ecosystem and you get to know how difficult it is, for instance, for those sharks to reach adulthood and how vulnerable they are as a species, the last thing you want to do as a human is to interfere in that grand scheme of nature that's developed over millions of years. It's not our place to interfere with that at all.
As you think about these kind of life lessons that this octopus is starting to teach you throughout the year, I mean, what is the process that you're going through? How is this octopus helping you heal?
Well, when you get taken, you know, into deep nature and into an animal's life like this, you get to realize how, first of all, how tough her life is and how dangerous it is. and how precious it is. And then as you, of course, I'm getting to know many of the other animals in the kelp forest as well. And eventually, and this is after, you know, just remember many years of diving every day, you have these glimpses of this giant biological mind, that this huge mind of Mother Nature that's really responsible for all of our well-being. The reason we can talk now, we can breathe, we can eat, is all because of that. We've lost that, you know, that knowledge. We've lost that understanding. But of course, that's what's happening. The foundation of every single thing we do on this planet as humans is thanks to Mother Nature and to this giant biological mind. So you start to have these great realizations, and it's all through these, you know, slow, deep understandings of creatures like this extraordinary animal that became to be my teacher.
Pippa, the project that you both work on, Sea Change, tell me a little bit about this area that Craig was in, but also kind of the larger challenges that kelp forests are facing.
So the Sea Change Project is the name of the organization that we work with. And it's a group of scientists and storytellers that have, you know, fallen in love with the Great African Sea Forest, which is the place where the octopus lived. And this is a vast underwater forest that stretches for more than 1,000 kilometers, you know, from South Africa all the way up the coast of Namibia. And the thing about kelp forests that very few people know is that they cover 25% of our global coastlines, but hardly anyone is speaking about them. You know, that's a huge chunk of marine habitat. And they have been labeled as the second most vulnerable marine ecosystems to climate change. So they are very, very precious places, but they're also in a lot of trouble. Places like Tasmania, parts of California, kelp forests have disappeared in just a matter of years. The reason that they're so important is they are huge sequesters of carbon. The biodiversity found in kelp forests is just extraordinary, as well as the abundance, which is the kind of mass of life that you find there. They also protect our coastlines from swell and storms, which is very important, you know, in the age of rising sea levels. So they're absolutely critical habitats, but there's very little conversation about what's happening to them. And with regards to our kelp forest itself, what we're hoping is to build a foundation of support in the hearts and minds of people all over the world, because the best way to protect an ecosystem against climate change is to make it as resilient as you can, to keep the community of animals as healthy as possible, to have a great level of awareness between, you know, the habitat and the people that use it about why it's important and how to behave within it.
So Craig, you know, there, speaking of adaptation and resilience, I mean, the octopus shows us things that I didn't know octopus could do. There's a scene where it's being chased by a shark and it just crawls up on land. I mean, and you had been following this octopus for months by this time, but did you expect it to just get up and keep going?
No, I mean, you know, so many of the things, Hari, that she taught me were massive surprises. You know, the intelligence of this animal is so extraordinary. It's equivalent to mammal intelligence or even primate intelligence. But this extraordinary thing about it is a lot of the cognition, actually 2/3 of the cognition, is in the arms, in the body, and outside the brain. So it's thinking in a completely different way to what we can imagine. So it's hard to get inside her head, inside her body, but what she's doing is just absolutely remarkable.
Craig, I remember a long time ago in like high school biology class, finding out that octopuses were colorblind, but I watch your film again and I still don't understand, how do they camouflage themselves if they don't know what colors are, but they fit so perfectly into their environment?
Yeah, a good memory. You're absolutely right. You know, they see in monochrome. So how on earth are they actually matching that color so well? And it's still a bit of a mystery. Also, what they sometimes do, which is fascinating, Hari, is if they can't match the color too perfectly, they'll actually look at another object or another animal near them and they'll match that. So you think it's just a abalone or some piece of algae on the rock, but they're not matching to their background. They're matching to something right next to them. So it's, you know, extra clever, extra sophisticated.
Craig, what are some of the things that you witnessed, things that you documented that haven't been seen before?
Well, certainly the, you know, the behavior with creating this armoring from the shells. That was something that I discovered thanks to her. You know, she's got a soft body. In evolution, she's given up her shell, so she's very vulnerable to attack by a shark who's got sharp teeth. So what she does is she lifts up shells and stones, sometimes up to 80 of them, and in a fraction of a second covers her whole body in the shell and stone armoring to protect herself from those sharp teeth. And then when she's, you know, finished with that, or the shark is confused, just at the right moment, she'll drop all of those shells and her smell will be on those and she'll vanish. And then the shark will often go for the smell on the shells and she's escaped. I also discovered, which I can't even remember, I don't think it's in the film, that a species of mysid, like a shrimp, that actually lives with her in the den. And consequently, some other species, so she helped me discover quite a few different animal species, new species to science. We saw extraordinary behaviors, like how she actually learns to deal with certain prey so quickly, like learning to hunt the lobster, and then even using me like a shield in the water when she's hunting. Incredible sophistication.
Pippa, what do you want people to take away from this film?
One of the reasons we didn't put a specific conservation issue into the film is we didn't want to make a movie about good guys and bad guys. We wanted to make a film that everybody was part of. And everybody is part of the story, because every single one of us, you know, no matter where you live, is dependent on nature and is dependent on the ocean for every breath that you take, every bit of food that you put in your mouth. And I think we really hope that people would start to think about the natural world in terms of what it means for our hearts, minds, bodies, and spirits. Because we have been part of nature since the beginning of time. And as Craig said earlier, we seem to have forgotten that somewhere along the way. And there is a different way of being on this earth. And, you know, we have this next 10 years that we're in right now, this is the time that we have to change the way that we treat the living planet. And if we do that, we can create any future that we want for all of the human species and animal species that come after us.
Craig Foster, Pippa Ehrlich, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Harry. Bless you. Thank you.
And you can watch My Octopus Teacher now on Netflix. And finally, from the depths of the deep blue sea to the red planet in outer space, this small helicopter named Ingenuity lifted off from Mars today, making history as NASA's first ever powered flight on another world.
It's the little helicopter with a very big mission. NASA's mini chopper named Ingenuity became the first aircraft to achieve powered, controlled flight on another planet. Ingenuity's first flight is intentionally brief.
Perseverance images showing us grounded at first. It's actually a video, which is great. It's grounded at first and then shows us hovering our 3 meters above the Martian surface and then touching back down. It's amazing, brilliant.
A short hop that is the culmination of many hits and misses. Ingenuity has so far survived the frigid Martian nights after separating from the Perseverance rover, relying on its solar-powered batteries to fire up internal heaters. But an initial spin test of its rotors delayed a scheduled flight attempt due to problems with a timer. NASA says the helicopter later successfully completed the test, spinning its blades at 2,400 revolutions per minute, the speed it needs to take off. Scientists say having a bird's-eye view of the terrain could revolutionize the way we study new planets.
Ingenuity will open new possibilities and will spark questions for the future about what we could accomplish with an aerial explorer. Could we image areas not visible from space or that a rover couldn't reach? Could a helicopter scout ahead for rovers and help plot the most efficient course for the best science?
Flying on the Red Planet presented some difficult engineering challenges because of the low gravity of Mars and an atmosphere that is 1% the density of Earth. NASA engineers sent along a good luck charm. Attached to Ingenuity is a piece of fabric from the wing of the Wright Brothers Flyer, which carried the first powered controlled flight on Earth.
Ingenuity's trip was modest, rising 10 feet in the air and hovering before touching back down. But the achievement is anything but. This was the reaction at Mission Control.
Altimeter data confirmed that Ingenuity has performed its first flight, the first flight of a powered aircraft on another planet.
Now, the results were transmitted back to Earth early this morning. NASA's ultimate goal, of course, is to search for signs of life on Mars. Project manager Mimi Ung said, "We've been talking for so long about our, quote, Wright Brothers moment on Mars, and here it is." And indeed, the mini chopper was outfitted with a tiny piece of fabric from the Wright Brothers' first airplane. That's history, and that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.